All right, guys, we have one more storyteller tonight. Everyone has been super wonderful. Please welcome our last speaker, the program manager at the Illinois Humanities Festival, as well as the founder director of Solanathon. This is Jane Beachy.
Hello, everybody. How's it going? Oh, good. It's a little bit intimidating being in a room full of designers because you are all very stylish, savvy people, and dark crystal, blingy shoes, violent femmes. You clearly have really good taste. So, good job on that. Okay. So, compliment someone on having good taste in music, and that person will probably not tell you that their taste traces back to someone else's. They will not confess that they got it from reading Pitchfork or Shazamming every song played in their cool friend's car. They will simply say thank you, because everyone wants to appear to have discovered good music on their own. Mm-hmm. I used to play that game when I was still intermittently trying to convince people I was cool. To a certain extent, it was true. I didn't learn anything musically from my older sister during my formative years. Mm-hmm. She was listening to a cappella music and Huey Lewis and the News during the mid-90s. It's hip to be square, anybody? No? Okay. So I did what any Delia's catalog subscribing teenager would do. I repeatedly joined Columbia House's program where you get 15 tapes for just pennies and then canceled the membership again before it got expensive and I got in trouble for rejoining it. I had no choice but to take stabs in the dark when making my selections, basing them primarily on band name and album cover. This produced mixed results. Jesus Lizard was not speaking to 15-year-old me, while Elastica knocked my socks off and had me speaking insouciantly in a British accent for weeks. During the desperately trying to be ahead of the game era, I focused on the artists and albums I found on my own or by coincidence, as if that somehow meant I had earned my fandom of them, had beaten all the bleeding sheep that had to be led to them. I regaled people with the story of that time I bought a used tape for $4 because the artist's name was unpronounceable and I was sure the music would make a great joke if. But after listening to Bjork's debut a few times through, I realized I was listening to a weird genius. But all of that doesn't paint the full picture. I'm leaving out one of my major influences and someone who is single-handedly responsible for much of my taste as a high school cool kid wannabe in the mid-90s, my short-lived boyfriend, Matt. Matt was a diminutive, broody dancer. He was my size. And I loved how our relationship kind of messed with people's ideas of gender and sexuality. Like, half the time I sat on his lap, and half the time he sat on mine. Matt was always ahead of the game musically. I don't know how he did it. Was he playing the same album roulette I was playing with Columbia House? He was the oldest in his family, but perhaps there was an older cousin. However he was doing it, he always seemed to have effortlessly assembled the sounds and accoutrements of coolness before anyone else even saw them coming. And let's remember that we are talking about the era of the mixtape. A single good mix could change your whole game in 90 minutes or 60 if you were using those cheaper Maxwell tapes. Matt made me a mix at the beginning of our relationship, and change my game it did. One piece of plastic and some ribbon introduced me to Liz Phair, PJ Harvey, The Pixies, Kate Bush, Kristen Hirsch, and more. This may all sound trite now, or you might just all be so much younger than me that you have no idea what I just said. That's fine. But for a young girl in the suburbs desperately seeking the sounds that could reflect her tormented spirit, the impact on my life would be immense. But not yet. I was young. I was that kind of young that meant I was still skeeved out by displays of affection from boys, even artistic boys with a lot of feelings. So I threw the tape in a pile somewhere and just mainly ignored it. Soon, between my tepid tape response and amid accusations that I didn't miss him enough when I went away for 2 weeks during the summer, Matt decided he was done with me, or I decided I was done with Matt, or we decided we were done with one another, or whatever it was, we were done. And this provoked that other seminal mid-90s teen tradition, the breakup note. I don't remember remember the exact contents of Matt's letter to me, though I do remember the following phrases scrawled in angry boy handwriting. You are very protective of your pain, girl. And I did not run off with Sarah, so fuck off from that. According to custom, this letter was folded 1 million times and passed to me in the hall during passing period by a mutual friend who just wanted to stay out of it. Before I could open the note and read all of these angry phrases, however, I was confronted with some strange poetry on the outside flap of the folded up note. I read it again and again, trying to make sense of it, and eventually I gave up. Only weeks later, riding around in the back of my friend's junky Honda, did it all come together in a whirlwind of truth. He'd done it again. Been ahead of the game. He'd discovered these immortal words, these eternal notes, before they had a hold on a whole generation. And to this day, when I hear this righteous melody, I see in his angry scrawl, I'm here to remind you of the mess you left when you went away. It's not fair to deny me of the cross I bear that you gave to me. You ought to know. Strangely, once he clearly wanted nothing to do with me besides reminding me, I was drawn back to his mixtape and finally discovered its many splendors. To think, for once in my life, I could have been legitimately a few months ahead of the game if only I'd listened when he gave it to me. But that's how it always is, right? It's the good advice that you just didn't take. Who would have thought? Figures.
Yeah, we did Ironic a couple months ago. Thank you, Jane.